Okay, the topic for tonight is providence and responsibility. The general problem is you're only responsible for what you do. We'll talk about this more when we talk about free will. But you're only responsible for what you do. Things happen to you, you're not responsible for. Providence is a word for what God does in running the universe. And the difficulty we have to worry about is maybe God is doing so much in running the universe, there's no room left for me. Maybe he's running it so completely, he's sort of smothering it, that I don't have leverage to do anything which will support my responsibility. In other words, this would really be a problem of taking a religious axiom and applying it to another axiom which is common to morality and to religion. Can we support God's providence together with human responsibility? Now, of course, that depends crucially on what you think God's providence is. How much is he doing? This subject is so difficult that there's a disagreement about whether or not there's a disagreement. That's philosophy. There are various pictures associated with the idea of divine providence. Some will tell you that the different pictures are held by different authorities. Others will tell you that all the authorities hold one picture. I'm not going to take you through that. Oh, thank God he's not going to do that. Okay. What I'm going to do is this. I'm going to give you the strongest picture. The picture that describes God as doing the maximum. Then we'll see if that picture of maximum divine activity makes trouble for responsibility. If it doesn't, then any other picture that reduces God's activity certainly won't make trouble. So we're going to start by making as much trouble for ourselves as we can. If we can squeeze out of that, then the others will be just a piece of cake, so to speak. All right, so let's see. What would be the maximal picture of God's providence? In Jewish sources, of course. I'm not talking about other religions now or other views. The maximal picture includes at least this, that every physical event is caused by God's will. Every physical event is caused by God's will. That means the ebb and flow of the tides and the beating of the wings of the mosquito and the motions of human bodies. Because a human body is a physical object, and what it does is a physical event. So according to this picture, every physical event, including all of our motions, are caused by God's will. Well, let's see. I give someone charity. He asks me for the money, and I take the coin out of my pocket and deliver it to him. Moving that coin means contracting muscles, relaxing muscles, motion of the arm, the fingers. Aren't those all physical events? And if we are now taking the position that every physical event is caused by God's will, then the whole performance of the body is a divine production. It's like a puppet on strings, and God is pulling the strings. Am I giving the charity? Or is God giving the charity? Can I have responsibility for the delivering of the coin to the supplicant if the whole thing is caused by God's will? That's the problem. Now, the solution takes several stages, and it will be important to see that we don't get a solution until the final stage. First of all, I said the idea of divine providence we're talking about includes, if you weren't still jet-lagged, and if it were 10 in the morning instead of 8:30 at night, your ears would already have pricked up. Why did he say includes instead of is? We'll come back to that. And I also said it includes that every physical event is caused by God's will. And if it were 10 o'clock in the morning and you're just after a cup of coffee, you'd have said, why did he put in the qualifier physical? Why didn't he just say every event is caused by God's will? If he puts in the qualifier physical, he says every physical event is caused by God's will, what is he implying? What do you think? See if you can say it carefully and get it right. What am I implying when I say every physical event is caused by God's will?
Well, we think about
I'm giving him this
one. Doesn't control our thoughts.
A little too much. First of all, I didn't say what the other realm is. You are assuming that thoughts are not physical. I want just the minimum inference based on the actual words I used, yeah?
You specified physical. It suggests that there's a focus only on the physical and not the other, which is the metaphysical.
All right, let's not even choose a table. There's another. There's some other realm.
Yeah.
Okay, now, what am I implying about the other realm?
Does it control?
Nope.
It may or may not.
Ah, that's well put. That's well put. The statement was that God's will blankets the physical. It causes every physical event. That implies there's another realm where God's will doesn't cause every event. It leaves open that it might cause some and not others. All you can infer is that it doesn't cause every event. Let's call the other realm spiritual. I'm not objecting to metaphysical or what other people said, but that's the term that I use. Let's call it spiritual. So what we have immediately is that there's a spiritual realm, and in that realm, God's will doesn't cause every event. As a matter of fact, it does cause some of the events. When we say that ideas popped into my mind, that's just a superficial, glib, irresponsible way of saying God did it. They didn't pop. They certainly didn't pop out of nothing. Right? You're supposed to believe in creation ex nihilo, right? Not if you're scientific today and you've outgrown the steady state theory. So, some things in the spiritual realm, God does cause, but some things not. Some things not. Now, step two. The soul is spiritual. So, what happens in the soul is in this realm where God's will causes some events and not others. And free decisions are soul events. It's the soul that decides. Not the brain. Not the rest of the body. And certainly not the atmosphere. It's the soul that decides. So, what we have so far is at least one realm where we do, and we do on our own. A realm where it's not God's causation. And that is taking free decisions in our soul. Are you with me so far? Now, it's crucial to see that this is not the solution to the problem. We haven't gotten there yet. Because you can't give charity in your soul. The soul cannot deliver the coin to the other guy. That has to be carried out by the body. And I want to know, can we be responsible for giving the charity? There are some philosophers who give you kind of stage directions. As they go along, they tell you, where are we? Where are we trying to get? How are we supposed to get there? I think that's very valuable. Jerry Fodor is one such philosopher, and his books are very valuable for that reason. So I'll tell you where we are and where we want to go. I have the free decision in the soul. I'm making that decision. We could very well say I'm responsible for the decision. Then you have the charity given, which is a bodily performance. And there, God's causing it. Our problem is there's no link, there's no bridge between the soul's decision and the body's performance. What we need to do is build a bridge so we can be responsible for what the body does also. Okay, time for what yeshivas they call a klutz kasha. Why don't we simply say that it's the decision in the soul that causes the body to give the coin? Wouldn't that be a good solution? That's terrible. Why is that terrible? Tell them why it's terrible.
Because we just said that God controls the body.
That forgets what the problem was. The problem was that God is causing the body to act. That's why we have a problem. That's why the decision of the soul is disconnected from what's going on in the body. To say that the decision of the soul is causing the body is just to forget what the problem was. We're trying to discover how I can be responsible for what the body does when I don't cause it. When indeed God is causing it. How could I still be responsible? So what we need is to build a bridge between the soul's decision and the body's antics. But not the bridge of causality. It's got to be something else, which yet enables us to see that we're responsible for what the body does. That's the problem. And here's the solution. Yes, God causes every physical event, including everything the body does. What we need to ask is, how does God decide what to cause the body to do? What does he take into account? What kind of criteria does he use in deciding what to cause the body to do? And the principle here is this. God has a policy of almost always causing the body to do what the soul has decided. I must remind those who, or inform those who don't know it, my background is in mathematical logic. When I give you a formula like that, I chose every word with care. Each word is put there to say it the way I'm saying it. If it doesn't get reported exactly, it isn't what I said or meant. Let's try it again. God has a policy of almost always causing the body to do what the soul has decided. Let's see how that works out in practice. Guy asks me for charity, and I consider my options. Do I have money in my charity account? Yes, I do. And he's asking for charity, and really, by rights, I should give it to him. On the other hand, I'm saving up to buy the latest release of the Tokyo String Quartet, which I think is the world's best string quartet. And I really want that music. I can't do both. I can't give the guy the money and buy the quartet. So I struggle, you know. Charity, yes. Quartet, yes. No, no. Finally, I say to myself, yes, I will give him the charity. That's the end of my contribution. That all takes place in the soul. Now, God, following his policy of almost always causing the body to do what the soul decides, causes the body to hand over the dollar to the poor person. What would have happened if I had decided otherwise? No, I'm not giving the charity. I'm going to buy the Tokyo. Then God, following his policy of almost always causing the body to do what the soul decides, would cause the body to not give the money, to remain quiescent and not give the money. Which means, I know that almost always the body will do what I decide. Not because I'm causing it. No, God is causing it. But because God has a policy of almost always causing the body to do what the soul decides. That's enough to be responsible. It's enough that I know that when I make my decision, almost always that's what's going to happen. Doesn't have to be that I cause it to happen. That being the case, I can be responsible for what the body does, even though I'm not causing it to happen. This means, let's elaborate for one moment, and I will take questions. I want to make sure this is understood. This means that every human action is really a partnership. It's really a two-part performance. The human being makes the decision, and God causes the body to carry it out. Means that God is very intimately related in our lives. And that will raise all sorts of questions about ethics and the rest. But that's how we can be responsible, even if the picture of divine providence is the maximal picture, that God is causing everything in the physical world. All the more so, as we said at the outset, if you have a more minimal picture, if you have a reduced picture that God does less, surely then you're not going to have any trouble with human responsibility. Okay, your question.
I'm interested as to the position of morality in these considerations. Now, I know I've heard that regardless of whether or not your decision is moral, God very well might even help you. Like as you say, like you said, God will almost always coincide or cause in your body what you've decided in your soul, or what I would say mind. I mean, like, would it be correct to say that I suppose that, like, the sometimes doesn't necessarily mean when you're not being morally good?
Oh, yes, it certainly does not mean that. Let me just comment what it does mean, because that was a point that I wanted to make, and it will help clarify what you're saying. Why do I say he almost always? Why do I say always? Because of experiences that we all have. You're swimming, and you catch a cramp in your leg, and you say, kick! And the leg says, no. Right? You're deciding, but the leg isn't doing it. Or you're in a concert and the music is very soft, everybody's silent, and you have to sneeze and you say, no, I don't want to do this. Please, please, I don't want to do this. And out comes the sneeze. So there are times when you decide and the body doesn't carry it out. That's a reminder that it's not under your control. But when you compare that to a day's activities, I put on my coat, I take off my coat, I make a cup of coffee, I drink the coffee, I dial my phone, I answer my phone, turn on the lights, turn off the lights, take a bus. I mean, you're making hundreds of decisions every few minutes, and the body carries them out. You don't even notice it, that the body carries them out. So on very rare occasions, God causes the body not to carry out what you've decided. But it's very rare. And as you are indicating, when a person makes a decision to do something that's wrong, God is also causing the body to carry it out. Quite correct.
So you're attributing those times when we cannot carry out our decisions to their fruition to, on the surface level, maybe a cramp or something environmental, but on an ultimate level to God, not seeing that as part of the plan for the day.
Well, what you say is correct, but I think put that way is quite misleading. I'm attributing the times when the body carries out my decision and the times when my body does not carry out a decision, I'm attributing both of them and all of them to exactly the same source.
Right.
God causing the body to do what it does. Yeah, in the back. Okay, yeah. I couldn't see it, yeah.
It seems on a very obvious observational level that when I think something happens because I'm thinking it, your proposal seems to be a little more complicated than that. What is it based on? Is there a passage in the Torah that says this? Where do we know that everything we do is because of God, and not just what we observe, where I think to lift my hands and it goes up?
Well, let's understand where we are now. We started off considering whether or not there's a contradiction between two Jewish ideas. We chose a definition of providence as maximal, and we asked, will that make trouble for the idea of responsibility? I'm pointing out that even if you take a maximal definition of God's providence, you can still make responsibility consistent with it. If someone opts for a weaker idea of responsibility, of course there's no problem. I'm sorry, a weaker idea of providence, of course there's no problem with responsibility. All I'm interested to point out now is that there's no contradiction between these two ideas.
So it's not necessarily a fundamental Jewish belief.
Well, some definitely hold that, right? I mean, the Ramban holds it, Avdesta holds it, and others. I think the Ramchal holds it. There are those who argue that there are weaker positions in the literature. I disagree with them, but as I said at the outset, I don't know if you were here at the very first few minutes, I said that I'm not going to fight that battle at the moment. I said there's a disagreement about whether or not there's a disagreement. Right, but my focus was the consistency of the two ideas, and that I think I have shown. Okay? Yeah.
We're under the premise now of the maximum, and you said that God controls the physical.
Causes. God's will causes every physical event.
Is there a physical and almost always the spiritual?
No.
Sometimes spiritual.
Yeah, that's right. Some spiritual, yes, and some spiritual, no. The almost always went into a third thing, that God has a policy of almost always, yeah.
So that is assuming we accept that premise, but like, how do you know that? Why do we accept that? You're just saying it, so we accept it, but how do we know that?
Well, as I said to Jonathan, my focus now is to say that there's no contradiction between two ideas. To show there's no contradiction, I don't have to verify that either one of them is true. I'm just saying they don't contradict one another.
So you're saying if we hypothesize about this, then X is the outcome. If we hypothesize about that, then Y may be the outcome.
I'm saying even less than that. I'm saying, let's see if I can put it this way.
Choose on the spectrum, it's possible that you're still responsible.
I mean, does an infinitely old universe contradict causality? I'm not saying it's infinitely old. I'm not saying there is or is not causality. I just want to know, does this contradict that? When I ask whether two ideas contradict one another, I'm not taking a position on either of them, either being true, either false, one true, the other false. I'm talking about a logical relationship between them. If I conclude that neither they don't contradict one another, that means I should investigate the two of them separately. And you know, I'm making a very minimal remark now. Just the two ideas don't contradict one another. Right? We do say twice every morning that God makes anew the work of creation continuously. That does sound like he's doing it, right? If he makes it anew, then it's hard to see anything else that's got leverage to operate on its own.
Well, what I'm saying is he may have total control over both worlds, the spiritual and the physical, then that's really the maximum.
We have to be careful now. Control is not quite the right word here. Control is a power. I'm not describing a power, I'm describing an activity. When you act, you often don't use all your powers. Can you control what your children do? Of course you can. You could tie them up. Right? You could put a gun to their head. You could push them around. You can. You have control. You choose not to exercise the control. So control is not quite the right concept here. Control is a power concept. I said at the outset, providence is a word for what God does. Not what God can do, but what he's actually doing. Now, as far as I understand the sources, the maximal picture in Jewish sources, and I said, I'm not talking about other religions. In Calvinism, for example, God does everything, including all human activities. And there is no free will. And they still think that there's some sense to that. So I'm not talking about maximal picture in philosophical terms. We're talking about our maximal picture. In our maximal picture, God causes all physical events, and at least free will decisions he doesn't cause, because if he caused them, then they wouldn't be free. Right? That's to say, there are free will decisions. And then, yes, I didn't say this, but I would go on to say that the rest are caused by God. Even the spiritual events are caused by God. So the only thing left is really free will decisions. A free will decision doesn't cause, since he wants them to be free. Yeah.
So if something physical happens to you that wasn't a result of your soul wanting it to do so, like it's like some kind of injury, like outside injury or some kind of like birth defect, is that because God made a mistake or lost control, or is that because he wanted that to happen to you?
So you know the answer. It's because he wanted it to happen. But your way of stating it also, I think, at least could be misleading. Nothing is the result of what your soul decided. Result meaning caused by. When your body carries out what you decide, it's God causing it to do it. When your body doesn't carry out what you've decided, God's causing it to do it. And when things happen that are irrelevant to your decisions, God's causing that to happen also. God's will causes everything that happens in the physical world. All of it.
So when a terrorist decides he wants to go blow some people up, then God allows him to do the action.
And allows is a little too weak. That is, he causes his body to carry it out. And I said this, if you rewind the tape to exactly 16 and a half minutes ago. Okay, I'm joking. It's not exactly, I don't remember exactly. But I did say that this idea of an action being a partnership is going to have implications for ethics. That's exactly what I was referring to. Yes.
And in the end, there's just a purpose for that.
Correct. Correct. Then you'll have to say there's a purpose for that. That makes the ethical question quite difficult. And we'll have to face it. Yes, that's quite correct. Okay, everybody with me so far? Good. Now, having said that, what can we say about human responsibility? How far does human responsibility go? We can't wipe it out with the idea that God is running the universe. Still, he is running the universe. How much must I do to organize my own life and to produce what I need for myself? How much can I rely upon God? And here, the problem is made vivid by clear sources that the greatest of Jews in history emphasized both ideas simultaneously. Jacob is coming back to the land of Israel, and he hears that his brother, Esau, is coming to meet him. And Esau is bringing along 400 men. They're not coming to roll out the red carpet. And Jacob is sore afraid. So he takes measures. First of all, he sends an elaborate bribe to his brother with a message of obsequious fealty. You know, I love you and I'm just hoping for your favor, and please treat me with gracious mercy and that kind of stuff. And he divides his camp and prepares for war. And he prays to God, save me from the hand of my brother Esau. So on the one hand, Jacob clearly believes in God and believes that God is the one who controls the outcome. On the other hand, he's also clearly taking whatever measures he can to ensure, or to, to respond to the challenge. Here's an especially striking one. God says to Samuel the prophet, I want you to go and anoint David, well, one of Yishai's sons, king. Now, Saul is sitting on the throne. Saul's in the palace, king of Israel. And God says to Samuel, I've had it with him, you know, I want to replace him. Go appoint one of Yishai's sons, king. And Samuel says to God, but Saul is going to hear about this and he's going to kill me. Now, what would you imagine God would answer to that? You're telling me? I'm God! I know that! Don't you think I took that into account? I'm telling you to go! That's not what God answers. God says to him, so to speak, good point. Tell you what you do. Take an animal with you. If somebody asks you where you're going, tell them you're going to offer a sacrifice. And go anoint Yishai's son as king in private. You know, keep it a secret. Now here's Samuel getting a direct order from God. And questioning the practicality of the action. And God agreeing with him that something should be done and giving him instructions. So it seems that on the one hand, we believe that God's running the world and every outcome is due to God's will. On the other hand, the greatest of our exemplars took quite careful precautions or measures to organize things in a way that would be successful. How can we put the two together? Let me put this in the form of a logical challenge. This is the kind of thing we used to put on examinations for graduate students to see if they would be candidates for the PhD. They got the answer, then we allowed them to pass on to write a thesis. If they didn't, we suggested they drive buses or do something else. Here's an argument which should prove that it's never appropriate to fix the brakes on your car. Let's see. Why would I want to fix the brakes? Because I want to avoid an accident. Well, either you're going to have an accident or you're not going to have an accident. Now let's see, if you're going to have the accident, why bother wasting the money on the brakes? You're not going to prevent it by fixing the brakes. And if you're not going to have the accident, then you don't need to fix the brakes. So, in either case, fixing the brakes is just irrelevant. The same argument you can make about going to the doctor. You're ill. Well, and this now we'll put it in theological terms. Person's ill. Should I go to the doctor, should I not? Well, let's see, either God wants me to be ill, or he doesn't want me to be ill. If he wants me to be ill, doctors can't fight against God. You know, if he wants me to be ill, I have all the medical intervention I like. It won't help. On the other hand, if God doesn't want me to be ill, then I'm surely going to be well, even without the doctors. God doesn't need the doctors to make me well. So either the doctors are impotent, in which case there's no point in paying them, or they're unnecessary, in which case there's no point in paying them. And therefore, there's no point in ever going to the doctors, no point in ever fixing your brakes. You know, God's running the world, or the future is what it is. Either way of putting the argument, you put it theologically or non-theologically. These are arguments which show that there's no point in taking any measures to affect any results in your life. Now listen. Listen. Everybody knows the conclusion is false. The conclusion is colossally dumb. Everybody knows you should fix your brakes, and everybody knows that you should go to the doctor. We all know that. And for 99.99999% of the population, that's enough. The conclusion is dumb, so let's forget it. But there's that 0.00001% of the population, they're called philosophers, who want to know, where does the argument go wrong? Of course the conclusion is dumb. But where exactly does it go wrong? The argument has a few steps. Can we pinpoint where the mistake was made? So let's go through again. I'll take you through the argument again. And you express your conviction by telling me where it goes wrong. Let's do it with the brakes. Step one. Either you're going to have an accident or you're not going to have an accident. Does that sound true? Like, you know, even if you die, you're not going to have an accident, right? Even if you don't drive, you're not going to have an accident. So either you're going to have an accident or you aren't going to have an accident. Okay. Step two. If you're going to have the accident, then fixing the brakes is impotent. It won't prevent the accident. There's no point in fixing the brakes if you're gonna have the accident.
The degree of the accident?
Well, yes or no. That won't help. Well, step three, if you're not gonna have the accident, then why bother fixing the brakes? The whole point in fixing the brakes was to prevent the accident, and you're not going to have one. Step four, that means in either case, there's no point in fixing the brakes, so therefore, there's never any point in fixing the brakes. You know? So now, we all agree that the conclusion is dumb, right? That's not up for grabs. The conclusion is terrible. But where does it go wrong? Where's the mistake? Okay, so it isn't as silly as I thought.
Isn't it a question of probability?
No, let's say it's all or nothing. It's much more fundamental than that. A simple fallacy being committed by this argument. Simple doesn't mean it's easy, but it's a simple fallacy. It's called the fallacy of equivocation. The words are changing their meanings in the middle of the argument. In the beginning, a word means one thing, and as you go along, word means something else. I'll show you how. In step one, we say either you're going to have the accident or you're not. That's surely true. The future has one or the other in it. Step two, we say, if you're going to have the accident, there's no point in fixing the brakes, because fixing the brakes won't help you stop it. There, what you're saying is, I'm going to have the accident means I'm going to have it no matter what I do. Nobody said that. Nobody said that. Step three, if I'm not going to have the accident, no point in fixing the brakes. Again, the assumption is, not going to have the accident means I'm not going to have the accident no matter what I do. Nobody said that. That's a brand new meaning for those words. Take that meaning, I'm going to have the accident no matter what I do, or I'm not going to have the accident whatever, no matter what I do. Put it back in step one. Step one now reads, either I'm going to have the accident no matter what I do, or I'm not going to have the accident no matter what I do. Baloney! Who says that having the accident will depend precisely on what I do? What's happened is, having the accident has changed its meaning. In step one, it just meant, I will or will not. Step two, it meant, I will no matter what else I do. I have no right to that. And it's certainly incorrect. It may precisely depend upon what I do, and that's why I fix my brakes. Okay, now let's take that for the sickness case. And now we'll get the answer to our question. So, either God wants me ill or he wants me healthy. That's correct. But when I say, then if he wants me ill, the doctors won't help, that doesn't follow. That says, if he wants me ill, he wants me ill no matter what I do. Who said so? Who said so? Maybe God's position on my health is this. God says, I want Gottlieb to be ill if he doesn't go to the doctor, and I want Gottlieb to be healthy if he does go to the doctor. Maybe God's will for me is conditional, and it's conditional upon what I do. Does this now begin to sound familiar? Isn't this exactly what I told you 11 minutes ago? That God wills the body to do what the soul decides almost always? Now God's will for the outcome depends upon what the person decides and what his body does. But it's the same idea of a conditional will. What God wills for you depends upon what you choose. So imagine God's will for me is this. Gottlieb will recover if and only if he goes to the doctor. Then going to the doctor is very important. Because that's precisely what determines is too strong a word. That's precisely what God is using as his criterion to decide what to do for me. You with me? So acknowledging that God's will controls everything and more than controls, causes everything in the physical world, doesn't mean that my efforts are irrelevant. God may want me to make efforts. And he may be using my efforts as the criterion for what will happen to me. And indeed, that is the case almost always. Just like my body. I know from experience my body does what I will. That's the way God treats me. That's the way God manipulates the body. So I know from experience, if I want the body to do something, I should will it, because that's what happens. When I will it, it does it. Same thing's true with outcomes. I know from experience that God wants my health to be a response to my using medical intervention, because the vast majority of the time, that's how I end up getting healthy. He's doing it, but he's doing it this way. And I learned from experience that this is the way he's doing it, and therefore I take responsibility for doing it, for the outcome by trying to control my circumstances. Are you with me? This means that the idea of divine providence, that God is running the world, and all the outcomes are due to God, does not lead to a kind of passivity and quietism and inactivity. God's running the world, you know. Let him take care of it. I'll give you the same idea the way the Chovos Levavos puts it. The Chovos Levavos puts it in the form of a very interesting argument. Take a person who's very pious and believes that God's running the world and that, you know, one should really trust that God's taking care of everything. But maybe we should open the windows because the air is getting kind of stagnant in here. Not to mention warm. Somebody get the window right there. Let me give the argument, then I'll take your question. Chosavos says, imagine someone brings you a freshly cooked steak, cuts it up on a plate, puts a piece on the fork, and places it into your mouth. Are you prepared to chew it and swallow? Or do you say, let God take care of the world, I don't have to do that? Now, of course you're going to chew and swallow. Now let's say he brings it to you and puts it on the plate with a knife and fork, but doesn't cut it up. Are you prepared to cut it up, put it in your mouth, chew and swallow? Of course. I mean, the person has to eat. Suppose he brings it to you raw. Are you prepared to cook the steak, cut it up, put a piece in your mouth, chew and swallow? Probably. Suppose he just gives you money. Are you prepared to go to the store, buy the steak, bring it home, cook it, cut it up, put a piece in your mouth, chew and swallow? Probably. Okay, suppose you'll only get money if you work. Oh, then people say, work? Me? No, I don't have to work. God's running the world. He'll take care of me. You know, it's all up to him. Well, then how come you chew and swallow? He doesn't need you to eat either. If he wants you to survive without eating, he can do it. Moses did it on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. No, chewing and swallow? That's okay. That's, you know, somehow, that's appropriate. That's all right. Just working is no good. Ma pitom, as we say in Hebrew. You know, who told you where to cut it off? Who told you where to draw the line? You learn from experience that God provides for some people when they put in certain types of effort, certain types of investment. And under those conditions, the person has to engage in those activities because that's the way God wants him to be able to survive. Now, your question.
Using the same premise, I think we have to also acknowledge the fact that despite our efforts, if God has a different plan, we've got no...
100%. You know, of course, we're not going to fight against God, and we're not going to succeed in fighting. Many people try, but you're not going to succeed in fighting against God. If he doesn't want the outcome, then it won't work.
Now, as an extension of that, it's quite difficult for you to answer this, but perhaps you have some thoughts on that. How do we identify what God wants? So let's say you're really going for something, and you keep getting knocked back and knocked back and knocked back. At what point do you say, right, I need to change my course, or this is just God testing me on my perseverance along the same path?
You are quite right. That is an extremely difficult question, and it's an extremely important question. Pritzadik, one of the great Hasidic philosophers, made the point very vividly. He said, we are told not to trust magic, not to read the entrails of birds or tea leaves and that sort of thing. Suppose I've chosen a goal, and I've chosen a means to achieve the goal, and I come up against obstacle after obstacle, and things become more and more difficult. And at what point can I say, God clearly doesn't want me to do this? And on the other hand, I've chosen the goal and the means, and I'm working at it, and things are going beautifully. I'm ahead of schedule, and I have extra resources, and, you know, things are going swimmingly well. At what point can I say, you see, God is confirming my choice. He's showing me that what I chose was correct. Neither of those inferences is correct, he says. We don't read the signs. Not that things are going extremely well, nor that they're going extremely badly. Abraham is on his way to sacrifice his son Isaac, which is a story unto itself. And the Satan creates a river, a raging river in his path. What does Abraham do? He says, look at that. I sent the river in my way. Thank God I'm going home. No, he wades out into the river up to his neck. And he says, God, you commanded me to do this. I'm ready to go. If I take another step, I'm going to drown. I won't be able to do it. But I'm telling you, I'm ready to go. And the river disappears. So how do you know? So if what you're trying to do is a mitzvah that you're obligated to do, then you should never give up. You should never give up. If it's a chosen strategy, where I've chosen a strategy where I'm not commanded to do it, so if it's putting on tefillin, keeping Shabbos, not speaking lashon hara about other people and so forth and so on, then spend your lifetime trying to do the best you can with respect to that. But you want to be a doctor. I know people to whom this has happened. They apply for medical school, they don't get in, basically their lives are over, at least until next year. Their feeling is, I have to be a doctor. If I'm not a doctor, I'm a nothing. I just don't exist. You know, so they put their lives on hold, you know, and they go, you know, wash cars or something, and you know, they wait for applications next year, because without being a doctor, they just don't exist. There, nowhere in the Torah does it say you have to be a doctor. You've chosen to be a doctor. And if you have a religious identity, you've chosen it because you think you can serve God best that way. But there's no specific commandment that you have to become a doctor. So then, I don't know any foolproof way to decide whether when it's enough effort and when it isn't enough effort. The best you can do is go to someone who is very knowledgeable in the Torah and who could get to know you reasonably well and tell you, according to his evaluation, his assessment, that this path is the one you should continue to try, or you should try something else.
What are you doing for dinner tomorrow?
Well, we will have some time. I'll be here with Hashem for Shabbos, and then we'll be together in Tzfas for the next Shabbos. But I think this is the only way to do it. And this, of course, is not infallible. Every human judgment is capable of being fallible. Every human judgment is capable of being fallible. But your job, and now I'm saying something that applies across the board, this is a very important principle. Your job is to do what is the responsible thing to do. The responsible thing to do is to get the best information you can get. Beyond that, even if the information isn't accurate, it's not your responsibility. No one can claim later that you did anything wrong. You did the best that you could. Okay? Yeah.
Somebody actually did the same question. So has God already decided what we're going to do, and he causes us to do the certain thing without us knowing it, or does he know what we're going to choose to do and just like waits for us to accomplish?
Okay, if you say he's decided and causes, that sounds like I'm not making the decision.
Right.
So we're not going to accept that. Yes, he knows beforehand what I'm going to do, and then what he causes to happen is his response to what I've chosen to do, but it's a response to what I've chosen. He's not making it happen. Free will is an absolutely cardinal principle in Jewish thinking.
When there is no free will. He already knows what I'm going to do. So whatever I do is actually right, right?
No, as a matter of fact, even though, well, let's put it this way, the contradiction between his knowing beforehand and my making free choices has at least four solutions, and one should not base any conclusions on the assumption that it's an insoluble problem, because it's definitely soluble. And we will get there. We'll have two shurim on free will, and if you like, I'll talk about that problem among others. So that wasn't my particular goal tonight. Are we together? Okay, I have two more comments to make. Then I've got to run to teach another group. What then does it mean to trust God? Trust sometimes is understood, if I trust you that you will do, then I don't have to do. If I really trust that you'll do, then it's not worth it's unnecessary that I should invest in it. It's a big topic. I'll just give you two of the standard responses. The Chazon Ish says, to trust God does not mean to read the future. To trust God, a person's ill, says, I trust God, does not mean I believe that I'm going to get well. That, says the Chazon Ish, requires prophecy. And we don't have prophecy. Once upon a time we did, and if a prophet told you you're going to get well, then it would be appropriate to accept it. That's not what trust means. Says the Chazon Ish, trust means that the future is not closed. No matter what condition you're in principle, anything can happen. The Gemara says, even when the enemy has his sword to your throat, you should not give up hope, because since God is omnipotent, whatever that means, we may not have time to talk about that, but since God is omnipotent, the fact that the enemy has a sword to your throat does not yet ensure that the person is going to die. It's a little bit like this. You have your picture of the future. So what we're being told is, in every picture of the future, there ought to be a block, an open block with a question mark in it. Leave that question mark there. Because it happens often enough in life that unexpected opportunities arise, and a person can be so programmed into an envisioned future, he doesn't even notice them. He doesn't even notice them. And then it's tragic, because he had a way out. He had a way out, and he didn't take it because he was so sure that the future was closed. That's one meaning of trust. And another meaning of trust, and this is due to Rav Dessler, is that whatever happens to me is the right thing to happen to me under my circumstances including the free decisions that I've made. So that the person is healthy or the person is ill, it's not happenstance, but this is what I need to deal with in my circumstances. That's also trusting. It's trusting in the sense that I'm in God's care. And this can have very, I would say, profound and challenging consequences. I will tell you a story, and with this I really have to conclude because I have to run upstairs. Otherwise I would stop and take questions, but I can't do it tonight. In Europe, when you had matzah for the Seder, very pious people used to go to the fields and watch the grain being harvested, and then take it to the mill and have it, and after the threshing, winnowing, take it to the mill to be ground to flour, personally supervising it so that it would not ferment, and also to invest it with their own care, and intentions, and love. And then they would have their matzahs, and the night of the Seder, at least for the Seder itself, they would use those matzahs. Fine, there was such a rav in Europe. And a few days before Pesach, he hired a new servant girl. And she was not very knowledgeable in Jewish customs. And the day before Pesach, the rabbi and the rebbe went out early in the morning. She was left home with the children. Children were asleep. Children woke up and they were hungry. So she looked for food to give them, and the pantry where the food is stored was empty. Apparently they had cleaned out all of the normal food and they were waiting for the influx of the Pesach food. And there's no food, and the children are hungry. So she starts rummaging through the house to find something. At the bottom of a cabinet, under some cloths, she finds a box. And in the box, there are some crackers. Oh, crackers! Thank God I found crackers for the children. And she gives them to the children. Good. The day wears on. Evening comes. And the rabbi says to the Rebbetzin, okay, bring those special matzahs, the matzahs that I went into the field to watch from the harvesting through to the baking. Bring them out to the table and we'll start the Seder. She goes to the cabinet, opens it up under the cloths, and she gives a geshrei, as we say in Yiddish, you know, a shriek. They're gone! The matzahs are gone! Whoa! The house goes into a tizzy. Everybody's searching up and down. What happened to the matzahs? Now this poor maid, this poor servant girl says to herself, I definitely did something wrong. You know, something's wrong with those crackers. You know, those crackers were—they looked at me like crackers. You know, so she finally goes. She can't have them searching when she knows the answer. She goes to the rabbi and she says, "Rabbi, I had no idea that those crackers were so important. You know, crackers. I feel terrible. I fed them to the children." He said to her, "You fed them to the children? Bring other matzahs. Let's start the Seder." Now, I think this is an exquisite story. I ask myself, how would I have reacted? And then I blush. How would I have reacted? I would have hit the roof! What do you mean? I spent weeks on this. You know, and this is the high point of the Seder. It's the mitzvah, the araisa, the biblical commandment, and you fed it to the children. You see, but his attitude was different. His attitude was, I spent all that time investing in making those matzahs for what purpose? The purpose, it turns out, was to do a kindness to a servant. That was the purpose. Because, you see, I was headed lickety-split one direction, and now I'm asked to make a right-angle turn. Instantly. And he made it instantly. That is what I would call spiritual virtuosity. He's a spiritual virtuoso. That you could take, here we're talking about a spiritual investment. It's one thing if you invest money in a stock and the stock fails, and to take it with equanimity, that's what God wanted. But here he wanted to do a mitzvah, which for him is the sea of his life. It's the high point of his life. And God says to him, no, it's a different mitzvah. That's not the mitzvah I want from you. I want the mitzvah of being kind to a servant. And he was able to switch and to say, so that's what God wants. That's trusting God. Trusting God that these circumstances are the circumstances that he wants you to deal with, and to deal with them in the spiritually correct way. Those are two meanings for trusting God. Neither of them compromises my need for taking the effort to provide for the conditions of my life on the basis of the patterns of nature that God uses as his criterion for determining what to give us.